Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. So much of how we live today is mediated by algorithms. Even if you don't own a smartphone or a computer, or if you shun social media, code is still controlling the contours of our social, civic, business, and financial infrastructures. That's a lot of power and influence in the hands of a relative few. Now, you know the cliches about coders, the programmers, for examples, and so many hoodies. But our guests today says it's time to understand this tribe, what makes coders tick, what they value, how they see the world, because that vision, those values are shaping everyone's world. This hour on Point, understanding coders. And you can join us. Are you a programmer, a computer scientist, a coder? What drew you to this world? What is coding culture like? And do the values close to a coder's heart, logical purity, radical efficiency, do those values translate seamlessly into the technology they're creating and into the world they're changing? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And a little later this hour, we're going to check in on that major plot twist in the case of Jussie Smollett. But first of all, let's spend quite a bit of time with Clive Thompson. He joins us from New York City. He's a journalist covering the world of science and technology, written for many publications, including the New York Times Magazine, Wired, and Smithsonian. And he's author of the new book, Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. Clive Thompson, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
It's great to have you. And by the way, I should mention to people that we've got an excerpt of your book at onpointradio.org. But Clive, I'm curious. Your book is all about coders today. We should make that distinction because the culture of coding today is quite different than it was in generations past, and we'll explore that. But why is it that you wanted to write about this or do this sort of anthropological take at who programmers are?
Well, I think it's because the average person understands now that code is all over the place and is affecting the way that they live their lives, the way that they learn about things, you know, on the news feed, the way that they order cars with Uber. They get that. But they have no idea how code is made, you know, or who are the coders, what do they care about, what are their priorities, you know, why are they building the things they're building. I really wanted to give people a deep glimpse into the types of folks who do coding so they could better understand the digital world around them.
And so where did you start looking for that deep glimpse, right? Because we could be talking about Silicon Valley coding culture. We could be talking about, the movement to diversify coding. We could talk about what it's like internationally. So where did you start your exploration?
You know, I started really by a combination of aiming at the really big names, you know, like I wanted to talk to the people that had been involved in what I considered to be some of the most consequential pieces of software of our era. You know, that includes things like the newsfeed or Instagram or Google's AI. I really wanted to get at that stuff because it has a massive impact. But I was also frankly interested in the whole kind of Linnaean classification of coders, you know, on down to the person that's sort of managing the JavaScript for the local bank down your street, right? You know? Because they're having an impact on your life too. And so I started, you know, making a lot of calls. A lot of these people I'd met, you know, over the years doing journalism. But in many cases, it was roaming the country, talking to people around the world to get this really broad view.
Okay. So let's then dig in where you begin digging in. You talked about the news feed, right? You call it the software update that really changed reality. Why'd you pick that? And then what entree did it give you to understanding this tribe of coders?
Yeah. I picked Newsfeed because it completely and like literally overnight, I mean, they turned it on, you know, in the middle of the night in August of 2000 and, uh, 2006. And it changed the way we pay attention to the world, you know, because up until then, a lot of people were using Facebook, but it was a slow and kind of inefficient thing. You know, I had my Facebook page and you had your Facebook page, and we sort of had to remember to go and look at each other's Facebook page. You know, has Clive updated his status? Has he put a picture up? And Mark Zuckerberg said, look, this is slow and inefficient, and I want to speed it up. And he decided that he wanted his coders to create this feed that would just automatically take stuff from people's pages whenever they changed it and give people this constant spray of information. And, you know, it very much did exactly what he intended. It completely changed the speed and the tempo and the breadth of how we learn about the world, because now you would just sit there in this stream of stuff. So-and-so posted a picture. So-and-so sent a meme. You know, I'm seeing the same story over and over again. You know, maybe I should go pay attention to that. It really changed things by focusing everyone, first in America, but then around the world, around this one piece of incredibly valuable real estate for where their attention lands.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted to start with Newsfeed.
So, I mean, absolutely. We now know that several billion people whose lives have been shaped by, or at least partially shaped by that news feed. Is it so in understanding the coders behind it, Zuckerberg, for example, I mean, he had a multifaceted goals for moving Facebook to the news feed. But there's sort of like a core value here that your book really explores really rather deeply. Things coming at you faster and more efficiently, right? So talk to us about that.
Sure. I mean, the one thing that unified basically every coder I spoke to is that they all are completely obsessed with optimizing things and making them more efficient. So whenever they see something that's being done slowly, it just bugs them. Like it almost on an aesthetic or spiritual level. They just get irritated by seeing things that are slow or repetitious. And so very frequently, they have this sort of X-ray vision. They're looking around the world and they're trying to see things that are being done slowly and how to speed them up. And that's exactly what Zuckerberg did with Newsfeed. He sped up and accelerated the way we pay attention to things. But you see it over and over again, you know. And it's largely because when you're a programmer, you know, you're working with a computer, and a computer can do things that a human can't. It's really good at doing repetitive things over and over again. We get bored, we tune out. It's good at being precise, you know, and we're not good at being precise. So coders tend to sort of, you know, lean into these weird abilities that they can get the computer to do, and they just get obsessed and fascinated with doing that in everything, in their personal lives and kind of in their commercial lives. You know, it's a very interesting common predisposition. I found it everywhere I looked.
Well, so this desire for efficiency, you talked to, as you say, you saw it in so many places that you looked, so many people you talked to, and it shows up in coders' ability or desire to squeeze efficiency out of every little corner of life. Like, you talk about the founder of the company Soylent. Can you just tell us a little bit about what Soylent is and what was unique about Rob, the founder?
Sure. Yeah. So you know, classic coder sort of way of looking at the world. He was cooking food, and you know, he was sort of saying, "I spend a lot of time on this, right?" Like, and it's the same thing every time. It's, you know, chopping up some ingredients and cooking it and then cleaning up. And he sort of, you know, in this very coderly way, you know, sat down and spreadsheeted the number of hours he was spending on cooking and preparing food, and said, "I want to speed this up. I want to get rid of this repetitive work." So he sat about trying to devise kind of like a goo that you could drink that would have enough nutrients in it that if you drank nothing but that, you know, you would remain fairly healthy and not die. Lo and behold, he creates Soylent, and it's sort of this perfect distillation of this manic desire to optimize everything, because he optimized meal eating, so it's nothing more than cracking open this bottle of pancake batter and drinking it. I drank a bit of it myself, just to experiment for the book, and it felt like this very pure distillation of the efficiency obsession.
Well, so I actually talked with him several years ago when Soylent first went on the market. I spoke with him as well, and I tried it. I didn't really like it at all, and I asked him. I said, "But what about the basic joys of cooking or the other sensory and sort of community experiences you get when over food? Why isn't that? Why should we want less of that? And he did return I wasn't judging, but I was just curious about why he felt that those things weren't necessary. And he just returned again and again to this efficiency question, that his time could be better spent doing other things. Now, I take him at his word. And at that time, Clive, I'll be honest, I didn't think Soylent was going to last. And yet here it is still. The company is surviving. So the coders are certainly onto something in terms of wringing efficiencies out of corners of our lives where we didn't think we could become more efficient or even wanted to, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, in a weird way, you know, efficiency is very much in the American spirit writ large, right? You know, it goes really deep. You know, Benjamin Franklin, you know, the sort of original hacker and life hacker, you know, was obsessed with trying to do things faster. And, you know, he had these little charts of all the moral virtues so he could track and, you know, how he was doing things. So there is, you know, there is over and over again, I think, in the American spirit, something that that dovetails nicely with this mania of coders. And I think it may be why America has been such a hotbed of companies that come out of the gate saying, here's our new app, here's our new software process that's going to torque up and speed up some part of your life.
So lots of benefits then, and as you're saying, perhaps deeply embedded in the American way of life. But you're also suggesting in the book that perhaps it's not such a great thing that coders or the people behind all these algorithms are seeking radical efficiency. Why not?
Well, it's because, you know, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit with efficiency. You know, as you point out, we get a lot of great things from it. But what started to happen, I think, really in the last 5 years, even as I was writing this book, was that we were beginning to grapple with some larger civic and economic implications of situations where coders came in and sped something up that started to have some weird side effects and made us realize that, oh, wow, we were sort of, as a society, relying on this being done a little more slowly, You know, there were good parts to the inefficiency.
Okay. Well, we're speaking this hour with Clive Thompson. He's author of the new book, Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. And we want to know what you think. Are you a computer programmer, a coder out there? Is this search for efficiency and logical purity that Clive Thompson writes about, is that the thing that drew you into the world of computer programming? What are the upsides to that? And what are the downsides to it? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Clive Thompson. He's author of the new book, Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. And we're exploring with Clive this culture of coders and who they are today, who the programmers are, what their values are, what drives them, and how that vision and that drive translates into the technology that they're creating that's changing all our lives. Now, programmers, of course, are a wonderful subject for satire or characters in entertainment. For example, this is from the pilot episode of HBO's Silicon Valley, and you're going to hear eccentric tech mogul Gavin Belson, played by Matt Ross, talking to his psychic guru about coders working for his company, Hooli.
That's weird. They always travel in groups of five.
These programmers, there's always a tall, skinny white guy,
short, skinny Asian guy,
fat guy with a ponytail, some guy with crazy facial hair, and then an East Indian guy. It's like they trade guys until they all have the right group.
You clearly have a great understanding of humanity.
That's from HBO's Silicon Valley. On the other hand, we have a completely different picture of a hacker. This is from the second season of USA Network's Mr. Robot. And hacker Elliot Anderson, played by the fantastic Rami Malek, uses a metaphor of the kernel panic. It's a really fatal flaw in coding to describe his own decline in his mental health.
My internal fatal error, from which my system cannot safely recover. Kernel panic. Day number 6 without sleep. I'm crashing. Next, my consciousness will go. The panic isn't settling in anymore. It's just there. The scream in my mind is coming back.
Rami Malek as Elliot Anderson in Mr. Robot. Clive Thompson, you know, I'm loath to generalize any group of people here, but you did try to do this sort of exploration and examination of commonalities in the personalities of coders, of programmers today. I mean, does Hollywood get it right in any way, shape, or form about what some of the personality types might be?
I think they're actually getting it more right a little bit these days. I've seen better representations on TV and in movies in recent years. Even some of Silicon Valley, like it was parody, right? But they got some of that stuff right. They got the sort of acerbic qualities that you often find, which a lot of coders would you know sort of shruggingly cop to me when we talked about it. They certainly got their obsessions with, you know, just latching on to some weird problem and solving it, even if it's kind of meaningless, right? Like you'd often see them, you know, getting obsessed with some weird little aspect of everyday life and trying to optimize it or torque it. So I think in some respects, actually, you know, we're maybe seeing, you know, kind of even in the joking parodic way, slightly better coders on the big screen.
Okay, so let me ask you a question here. What's your Myers-Briggs type?
Oh boy. You know, I can't remember. I did this a while ago. I do know that I did it with my wife. We were both journalists. We both came up with the one that is exactly the journalist. I can't remember
okay.
It. Don't ask me to pull it out here because it's not in the storage.
Now, people can poke holes in what Myers-Briggs actually tells us about personalities. But you know why I'm asking, right? Because you have a whole chapter in the book called Among the INTJs. And here's why I want to explore this chapter with you, because when I got to it, I was like, oh my God, I have taken Myers-Briggs for fun like multiple times, and I've consistently for a couple of decades now came up as an INTJ. And
No way.
Yes. No,
oh my
absolutely.
God.
Consistently since 11th grade when I first took my first Myers-Briggs. And I just thought, oh, did I end up in the wrong career here? So,
right,
so
right.
What are the personality traits in this
sure.
chapter that you think are sort of unifying amongst people who are drawn to computer science?
Okay. So one of them that comes up pretty frequently is that they are really precise. You know, like to code well, you have to be incredibly meticulous because the machine will do what you tell it to, but only if you give it the exact right instructions. And that eventually starts to really kind of leak into your soul, right? So a lot of coders would, you know, find themselves very irritated by lack of precision mm-hmm. in their everyday lives. It makes them intolerant for vague language, makes them intolerant for kind of vague concepts, right? So that was a very common one. I think there's also like a, you know, like a, an engineering logical problem solving thing that kicks into gear because you're constantly having to solve these little puzzles and problems by breaking it down.
Yeah.
And that again, people would say sort of bleeds into their personal lives in a sometimes problematic way. They would, you know, come down for dinner and start, you know, critiquing, you know, the flow that their partner is cooking the rice with because they're like, you know, I feel like you haven't thought through this process very carefully. You know, a lot of them would say it you know, it can make me a little weird to be around sometimes.
So then these things do translate outside of the professional field. But there's also the the parts that spoke to me were this sort of high tolerance for endless frustration, the deep desire for immersion as well, and the sort of relentless pursuit of process improvement. These were all things that I thought, oh, I actually kind of innately understand why these are very attractive ways of being here. So, but what is it about those personality, those aspects of one's personality that makes for a good coder?
Well, you know, the thing you raised is really big, this fact that they're able to endure unbelievable, crushing levels of frustration is quite central, because I think it's actually what drives some people away from coding. They don't realize when they move into it that they are going to be having things broken and not working like 99% of the time. We have this vision from, you know, years of bad Hollywood versions of coders and hackers that what coding is sitting down and just, you know, this code flowing out of you. But what coding really is, you know, writing 10 lines of it and trying to run it, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work already. You're the failure. You did something wrong. And it might take you, you know, a few hours, a few minutes. You're not sure to get that working. But there is this just constant crushing, no, no, no. The computer's sitting there refusing to do what you want. And that becomes, I think that sort of is like almost a forge for the soul. The people who can excel at this are the ones that can just drive the nails into the floor with their forehead.
Those are some tough foreheads here. But
yeah, exactly.
Okay, so look, we could spend the whole rest of the program talking about sort of the wonderful details that you've uncovered in your many conversations in trying to understand this current tribe. But I do want to once again emphasize that we're talking about who a lot of coders may be today. So we are talking about mostly men and mostly white men, because there is a diversity problem in tech, and it's been chewed over a lot, and we will do that again here. But you also spend some time in the book talking about how it wasn't always like this, that the kinds of personalities or the people who were drawn to computer science was quite different in years and generations past. So talk to me a little bit about that. How different was it 50 years ago?
Well, when coding started, you know, which you could say is kind of being the late 50s, when they started to need to hire coders, it was very open in a way. It was more open than it is today, because no one knew how to code. No one had studied it. There were no schools. So they would just essentially test you and see if you were kind of good at solving logical puzzles. And if you were, they would train you on the job. And so a lot more women got in through that door back then. The government's, you know, statistics show that in 1960, 27% of all the people that were coding in the United States being paid to code were women. And that's astonishing, because the period was otherwise extremely sexist, right? Like, you know, women were not getting to be trial lawyers or surgeons or all sorts of other elite occupations. And yet they were able to get into coding. And that changed dramatically. It rose over the over the 70s and 80s, peaked at, you know, in the low 30%, and then began declining, because as you point out, the field became much more male, much more young white guys, and such that by 2013 there were less women in coding than there was in 1960.
Right. So we want to talk about what the impact of that shift is here, because especially, again, Clive, returning to the big question you ask in the book is, here are a group of very influential people who are having an impact on all of our lives. So what does it mean, or what is that impact, given that many of them come from a particular slice of life? So Clive, stand by here for just a second, because I want to welcome into the conversation Vaidehi Joshi. She's joining us from Portland, Oregon. She's a writer, speaker, developer, and engineer at Tilda Inc., where she works on Skylight, a performance app for software engineers. Vaidehi is also creator of Base.cs and co-host of the Base.cs podcast, a weekly series that unpacks the basics of computer science. Vaidehi Joshi, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So tell us, what first drew you into the world of programming?
Yeah, I think I was actually dabbling in programming before I really knew what it was. I'm from that generation where, you know, you would come home after school and like work on a GeoCities website. And, you know, that is a lot of that is like working on the web. But at the time, I didn't realize that that was programming, I didn't realize that that was related to technology, really. It was just, like, fun to come home and tinker with this little website. And I didn't really get into it till much later in my career. I'm actually a career switcher, so I didn't actually really get into it till I was about 24.
24 still sounds so young to me, but and so, but when you did, what did you find that coding gave to you or allowed you to do or fulfilled in you that you weren't necessarily feeling beforehand?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing with programming and coding is that it is incredibly empowering and liberating to be able to create something that can touch so many people's lives. And that was the thing that made it very compelling to me. And there is very much the logical aspect of it, which you sort of talked about earlier in the program, but there's this element of creativity as well, where in the problem-solving process, sometimes when the computer is not doing what you want it to do, you might have to kind of switch gears and think of a creative way of making it work. And that was really, really fun for me because it gave you this interesting way of trying to flex your logical muscles, but also being able to create something that could impact someone on the other side of the world who you may not even ever know or meet.
Right. And so talk to us then a little bit about this culture that Clive Thompson is exploring and laying out for us as he sees it in coders today. Because, who the coders are and how they're having an impact on the world really matters. And it's resonating with some of our listeners. We got a comment here on our website. Hello Kitty says, the products and services people develop are reflections of the people who create them, that products mm-hmm. who are developed by a few will not adequately meet the needs of many. Products mm-hmm. that are developed by a diverse group will be much more successful. So do you see a kind of myopia in your world now of coding in terms of what problems are worthy of solving?
I think there is definitely truth to that comment. And I agree with it. You know, if you think about it from this perspective of people who are building things, it's hard to build for a group of people if you cannot put yourself into their shoes. And so when you think about software engineers and developers and coders, it's very hard to consider a group of people if you don't see yourself reflected in them. And so when you have coders, this world of coders inhabited by a group of people that all looks the same, for example, all men mm-hmm. or all white men or all people with computer science degrees, maybe you're not considering someone who might be using your product or app who doesn't look like you. And that's why I think it's so important for this group of people who's building for everyone around the world to look like the people around the world. Right. And I definitely wish that there was a bit more of that. I do think it's getting better, but we have a long way to go.
Clive Thompson, let me turn back to you here because it's turning my mind back to the very first example we started with about the news feed that, for example, Facebook has long said, Mark Zuckerberg said he sees a core value in connecting as many people as possible around the world, but maybe didn't or couldn't anticipate that same level of connectivity would lead to, politically violent mobs in Southeast Asia or fake news flooding the entire world here, because that's not sort of where he was thinking the benefit that he was considering when it came to connecting people.
Yeah, I think it's definitely true. And I heard from a lot of people who were around in the early days of social media, places like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, that they were all fairly naive, I suppose, and optimistic with these kind of gauzy ideas that merely connecting people, merely allowing for new and faster ways to communicate would improve society. And I mean, I'll cop to being naive about that too at the time, right? Like, I mean, I don't think I foresaw or tried to foresee some of the side effects that would come. And I think it was exactly what Vaidehi is talking about here, a sort of a narrow worldview from a bunch of people that were focused on just solving a technical challenge and not thinking, about the lessons from history, which, if they had gone back and, you know, or even I as a journalist had gone back and looked carefully at, you know, the introduction of things, even like radio, mm-hmm. other forms of mass communication, you would see that they were used for enormous good, but they also gave rise to, you know, new abilities for fascists like Hitler, right? And so probably, I think, a wider view, more informed by history, by culture, by a more diverse array of participants, might have got a little ahead of the ways in which these social networks got hijacked.
Right. I mean, we can also look to the history of science for another maybe parallel example, that when physicists first tried to split the atom, right, they weren't necessarily thinking, well, very soon thereafter, they did start thinking about weaponizing that technology. But the very earliest physicists weren't necessarily thinking about that. So,
And let's be clear also that the demographic homogeneity of it all being young men was very significant in that, you know, young white guys, and I know because I've been one, don't get anywhere near the amount of abuse when they act in public than women or people of color do. So you had development teams that were, you know, simply unaware of and unable to foresee the forms of abuse that were quickly going to arise on their platforms.
Because, as you said, it was never part of their life experience. Well, Clive Thompson and Vaidehi Joshi, stand by for just a second. Got to take a quick break. We're talking about Clive's new books, Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. And we're trying to understand who computer scientists and programmers are today, what their values are, and how those values translate into the technology they're making that affects all of our lives. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunio was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Clive Thompson. He's author of the new book, Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. Vaidehi Joshi also joins us. She is a writer, speaker, developer, and engineer at Tilda Inc., where she works on Skylight, a performance app for software engineers. And let's go straight to the phones. Peggy is calling from Jefferson City, Missouri. Peggy, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello. Just joining to say I'm not part of your standard group. I'm 67 years old. I've been coding since 1973.
Terrific, Peggy. And so how have you seen coding, or I should say the culture of coding, change in that time?
It is getting a lot more popular with, well, a lot more sophistication and mystique and that sort of thing. We just looked at it as a way to make money.
Hmm. Well, Peggy, thank you so much for your call. Vaidehi Joshi, let me turn back to you here, because it's great to hear that Peggy's been able to be in the field for so long. But as we touched on earlier, there have been many calls to diversify coding now, to diversify tech, especially on the issue of race and gender here. Do you see that as a necessity?
Oh, absolutely. I'm really thrilled that Peggy called in, because sometimes people often say that women in tech like don't exist, or, you know, you don't see them that often. And they do definitely exist, as she is a great example of. But I do think that finding women who are very senior, who are in positions of leadership, who've been in the field for a long time, that it seems to be a little bit harder to find in my experience. And that's something I want to see change in the technical industry. I want to see more women actually stay in the field. And it's something I feel like we really need to work on. You know, people talk about the pipeline problem. There are all of these organizations and initiatives to get young girls and young women interested in computer science, to tell them to major in it and get them excited about it. But one of the big questions I feel like sometimes we forget is, okay, once they're in it, how do you keep them there? How do we make these companies and, you know, events, these conferences, open source communities, how do we make them welcoming enough so that women want to stay, and that so that we see this wave of women advancing to more senior positions.
Right. Well, Clive Thompson, you write about this in the book, that perhaps the problem, as Vaidehi is pointing out, isn't necessarily a pipeline problem, but another one. You call it the myth of the meritocracy in coding culture.
Right, yeah. There's this idea that's quite deep, certainly in Silicon Valley, that the people who are in the jobs, the coding jobs, the engineering jobs, the managing jobs, are there because they're simply the best. That when you're coding, it is a very fair test of your abilities, you know, whether or not the code is running or not. You cannot lie to the computer. You have to give it the correct instructions. Therefore, that concept of merit obtains all the way up, you know, to the vice president and CEO suites. It's simply not true, right? I mean, there are all sorts of there's all sorts of documentation of this going back decades of this, you know, this attitude of culture fit in hiring, you know, which is that the people that get promoted and often the ones that get hired in the first place are the ones that the guys in charge, and it's mostly guys, sort of feel an affinity with. You know, they're like a younger version of me, or that's how I was when I was that age. So, you know, I expect a coder to look like a young guy in a hoodie. And you know, on top of that, you know, there's a lot of tolerance for, you know, flat out harassment at a number of companies, you know, that goes back decades. So all these things, you know, Vaidehi is exactly right. These need to be dealt with because, you know, the quote unquote pipeline, getting young women interested in coding, that is improving dramatically in recent years. Mm. There's a lot more that are doing it, that are applying to computer science degrees, that are doing boot camps. But the industry itself needs to reform its ways to be able to accept and advance senior women so that there are a lot more senior women who decide to stick around instead of going, I've had enough of this harassment. I'm getting out of here.
Well, Vaidehi, we were getting some pushback here online. Commenter Josh says, no industry needs a gender balance just for the sake of gender balance. Josh says, where's the push for balance in jobs like childcare and nursing or waste management or truck driving? How would you respond to that?
Oh, I think that there should be a gender balance. I just am not pushing for that because I don't know that world as well. But I feel like, you know, we need more men in nursing positions. We need more men in education roles. I think this kind of goes back to what Clive was speaking about, where when it comes to positions of power in particular, which coding has obviously come to the forefront of that now. We need to start questioning who are the people and what do they look like and what are their life experiences when they're the ones who are in power. And if coders are the ones that have so much control over what gets built and how it's being built and the questions that we're asking, then of course we need to think about who those people are. And I think many of the things that Clive's book touches on kind of highlights why we need to be questioning this. But I am all for a gender balance in all the industries. This is just one that I think is kind of at the forefront of everyone's minds because it impacts all of us, whether we realize it or not.
Well, so Clive, dovetailing with this issue of whether it's important to diversify tech is also, you know, I keep coming back to these are folks who are making technologies that are vastly transforming our lives as we've been discussing this hour. But did you find in your explorations, in your research, that there was a sense that they ought to take responsibility for those technologies? And I ask specifically because I'm thinking of some very high-profile Silicon Valley folks, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, Peter Thiel, et cetera, who are, you know, avowed libertarians more than anything. And so perhaps the idea of taking responsibility for the effects of their technology isn't even part of their worldview.
Yeah, there is definitely a libertarian tinge to what you see at the high levels of Silicon Valley. It's probably not as much as you might imagine. Thiel is a super libertarian, but when you actually study the attitudes of a lot of tech CEOs, they're actually fairly standard democratic style people who are happy to have government involved in a lot of aspects of life. The one area where they are extremely opposed to government regulation is in labor. They want to be able to hire and fire and think that the government should have no particular say in how talent is acquired. But, you know, you ask about responsibility, and I think quite apart from questions of libertarianism, these companies now that are very consequential, Google, you know, Facebook, they're just huge corporations at this point in time. And they therefore, I think anyone who studies society would argue they bear responsibility for the effects they have on mass, right? This is exactly why Congress is getting so interested. If the companies themselves don't want to take account for their civic impact, then the government will demand they do so. And it might turn out much worse for them if they don't get behind it themselves, is what I think.
Well, let's sneak in one last call here. Let's go to Lloyd, who's calling from Rapid City, South Dakota. Lloyd, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Go ahead, Lloyd.
I've been listening to you guys, and you've got one thing really right. I'm a Google contractor, and Silicon Valley is filled with over 8,000 people from Asia, from East India, Asia, the white guys, you know, probably 90%, 95% of the coders and computer scientists are made up from this group. And women are a small part of that. But to get back to coding is going to not be as significant with artificial intelligence and machine learning in the future.
Right. Well, Lloyd, thank you so much for your call. Lloyd saying that perhaps coders themselves will be replaced by the very technology they're creating. Clive Thompson, we've got just a few seconds. Do you want to just respond to what Lloyd said?
I think coders are going to get a lot of AI in there, but there's still going to be a need for coders very much in the decades to come.
Well, Clive Thompson's new book is Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Clive, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was fun to be here.
And Vaidehi Joshi, writer, speaker, developer, and engineer at Tilda Inc. and creator of Base.cs and co-host of the Base.cs podcast. Vaidehi, it was terrific to have you. Thank you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, when we come back in a moment, we're going to take a look at the latest questions in the case of Jussie Smollett. This is On Point. Well, on Tuesday afternoon, there was a sudden twist in the case of Empire actor Jussie Smollett. Cook County prosecutors in Chicago dropped charges against Smollett after he had been accused of lying to the police about being the victim of an alleged hate crime. And joining us now with the latest is Miles Bryan, reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. He's been covering this case. Miles, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first of all, we'll get to sort of the details of what happened a little earlier this week, but I understand there's some recent news with just the case of Jussie Smollett. What's just recently happened?
Well, it's unfolding in real time. As we're speaking, his police report is being made public in response to some FOIA records, and there's a question of whether his court file, which was under seal as of yesterday, will be unsealed soon. So when we finish up our conversation, I'm going to run to the courthouse and see if I can get a hold of that. But that would answer a lot of questions because Smollett, you know, the shocking thing here is all of his felony charges were dropped yesterday in return for something called an alternative prosecution, which is pretty minimal. He just had to do a few days of community service and turn over his $10,000 bond. And that has been got a lot of folks scratching their heads right now.
Yeah. So what did prosecutors say about why that happened?
You know, they say that they do alternative prosecutions all the time and that, you know, this was a nonviolent felony and Smollett doesn't have much of a record. And this is sort of consistent with their vision to save resources for violent crimes. You know, they point to thousands of these happening every year, but you know, from folks we've talked to, a former county prosecutor, it doesn't seem consistent that this happens with big heater cases like this one, where there's a huge amount of attention. And also considering the fact that the Chicago police were so, out in front and aggressive in making their case against Smollett. And they spent so many resources on that, too. I mean, there was a dozen detectives working this for weeks at a time, and there was some real anger from the police community about the waste of time that they had gone through. So the fact that he now faces no criminal charges countywide is really surprising.
Right. So remind us then, because there were several alleged incidents that that put this case, as you say, like made it headline news. So what was it that Smollett was charged with?
Yeah. So if you remember, Smollett a couple months back said he was attacked by two men in downtown Chicago. He's black and gay, and a star on the show Empire. And these men, he alleged, used racist and homophobic slurs, put a noose around his neck, said this is MAGA country. Obviously, that got a huge amount of attention. But then over the next couple of weeks, police turned their attention from finding his alleged attackers to thinking that he staged this hate crime on himself, which was a really shocking turn. I mean, he had gone on Good Morning America and defended himself, saying he would never make this sort of thing up, and really riled up internet people, Twitter people on both sides. It sort of caught the whole country up, depending on what sort of lens that you view the world right now, right? Whether this was the terrible hate crime that represents the moment we're in, or whether this was overblown or fake. And then a couple weeks ago, the police came out and said, formally charged him, and he was indicted by a grand jury.
Right. Well, we have some tape of what Jussie Smollett himself said yesterday after the state made the decision to drop the charges and seal the records, which I guess as we're having the news change around that right now. But here's what Jussie Smollett said in a statement to the public.
I want you to know that not for a moment was it in vain. I've been truthful and consistent on every single level since day one. I would not be my mother's son if I was capable of one drop of what I have been accused of. This has been an incredibly difficult time, honestly one of the worst of my entire life. But I am a man of faith, and I am a man that has knowledge of my history, and I would not bring my family, our lives, or the movement through a fire like this. I just wouldn't.
That's Jussie Smollett yesterday. Well, on the same day, Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson spoke to the press saying, quote, "They chose to hide behind secrecy and broker a deal to circumvent the judicial system."
Do I think justice was served? No. Where do I think justice is? I think this city is still owed an apology. And let me digress for a moment. When I came on this job, I've been a cop now for about 31 years. When I came on this job, I came on with my honor, my integrity, and my reputation. If someone accused me of doing anything that would circumvent that, then I would want my day in court, period, to clear my name.
That's Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson. So we've got some comments coming here online. Rufus Roden is saying, the prosecutor said that he still believes Smollett is guilty, but the forfeiture of his bond and a few hours of community service was just. What really happened is that a rich guy was just allowed to walk away from the 16 felony charges with a slap on the wrist. I mean, how is this all going over in Chicago?
People are angry. The mayor is angry. The Chicago Police Department superintendent, as you heard, is angry. There's just a lot of questions and a lot of frustration about, what the heck is happening here. It's worth pointing out that the state's attorney's office is a separate body. They get information from the police, and they do what they will with it. I mean, they can choose to charge. They can choose to not charge, whatever. There was a lot of editorials I read this morning basically calling on the state's attorney to give some kind of answer about why this happened. And what adds another layer of mystery to it is the state's attorney, Kim Fox, had recused herself from this case because she had been in touch with some folks who were advocating for Jussie Smollett early on. So this decision allegedly was made by her top deputy. But we still don't quite know what happened, and it's unfolding minute by minute. So I'll have to keep you guys posted.
All right. Well, Miles Bryan, with a lot of reporting ahead of him, general assignment reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Miles, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title. And a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.